A new novel from Atlanta author Mann Martin manages to be both incredibly informative on matters of trivia, ranging from grammar to neurology, and just plain funny, too. That novel is The Lemon Jello Syndrome. The protagonist is Bone King. He's an English teacher who develops a sudden and mysterious neurological impairment. He cannot go through doors. Bone seeks the help of a famous neurologist named Dr. Limongello, who offers him a diagnosis. Lois Reitzes recently sat down with Mann Martin and asked how he decided to name his main character.
Originally, I thought the story was going to be a kind of a fairy tale called a Jack tale. But I thought Bone King was going to be a villain, almost like an ogre. And so his name is actually quite sinister. Bone King, like a skeleton king. By the time I realized he was actually sympathetic and the heart of the story, I was so attached to the name, I couldn't shift it. And so in my mind, he was Bone King at that point, and so the name stuck.
Oh, now you have to tell us what a jacktail is.
A jacktail is the damnedest thing. It's an Appalachian fairy tale. And the protagonist is always named Jack, and he doesn't care to work. He runs away from home, and he'll be walking along in the woods, and he'll meet some old coot who will say, "I'm the king of West Virginia." And it is the king of West Virginia, and he's got a castle and a beautiful princess, and there's a dragon. And it's like any fairy tale you've ever read, and Jack outsmarts the dragon or whatever he does, except it's set in Appalachia. And there's this weird cognitive dissonance when you're reading one or hearing one that you know this is, you know, again, somewhere from the Smokies to the West Virginia, and yet it is, to all intents and purposes, a fairy tale, with all the traditional fairy tale tropes.
You write, "Wherever he went, Bone was accompanied by a silent inner voice, a running commentary on usage and etymology." Man, you teach English. Do you go through life with that inner voice?
I go through life with so many inner voices. It's surprising that I go through life, end of sentence, full stop. I probably should not be trusted with anything sharper than round-nosed scissors. I'm constantly distracted and preoccupied, among other things, with words and usage. But yes, I am constantly thinking of how language is used, origins of words, and every spider web those subjects lead off into.
So there's some of you in Bone.
Oh, definitely. I think, and this is probably true of most writers, every character I write is some distorted reflection of myself. I can't write a character that's not in some way me that I've projected myself into.
Here I have tried to be very cautious about inferring from characters that, okay, this is really the author herself or himself. And I find this very validating to you.
Well, good. Well, be careful, because very little that appears in a story do I make up, but it's scrambled biography. And so you're like a scavenger looking around for pieces of spare lumber that you can pick up and somehow cobble into the shape of something. And so I'm always have my antenna out, my own experiences, things I hear, things I read that go into some sort of Cuisinart of my mind and come out, and every piece is recognizable, but it's chopped in confetti and then repasted together.
Of course. If you want to know about the author, read the author's bio. Don't try
exactly.
And glean
exactly.
What you can from the fiction. Do you share Bone's sentiment that people don't respect language?
I think it's true. As a Southerner, of course, and an English teacher, I sort of carry two chips on my shoulder. I don't know if there's really a loss of respect, but there's an absence of respect for the beauty of the language. But on top of that, Southern English is a lovely dialect. It really is. It's supple and graceful, And alas, probably under the force of mass media, it's slowly being erased. But nevertheless, yeah, I think language is a lovely thing. Bone is a bit more of a curmudgeon than I am. I'm not quite as fussy in particular as he is. I do accept that languages change, and change is part of their beauty. You can't hold things still forever.
As an Atlantan, it's fun to recognize numerous places you describe, from a Vietnamese restaurant to Northside Hospital, Skyland Kroger, Oglethorpe University. How do you balance writing for a general readership with knowing that locals will particularly appreciate certain references?
My attitude is the general readership be damned. You know, they're going to read it. It'll be a place. It'll be a place marker. But the real reason they're in there is because I find it hard to write myself if I don't have a clear sense of place. So I need to know clearly in my own head, if I'm going to turn out of my house and go to work, am I turning left or right? Am I going to pass a grocery store before I get there, or would I have to go to a grocery store later? And those sorts of things ground a writer in the geography of his fiction. So even though it's got real places, in a sense, the setting itself is deeply fictional.
What is it about Atlanta that provides inspiration for your setting of this story?
I think Atlanta is a city. It's both a southern city and it's deeply not a southern city. And if any place that I've ever lived that embodied the New South, whatever that might be, it's Atlanta. And Bone is a man with his foot in two different worlds. He's an academic, but at the same time, he is a Southerner who's somewhat self-conscious about being Southern. Atlanta is a very different city. It's there, you know, people, and perhaps Southerners, but definitely people outside the South, think of the South as this big gelatinous mob of people that are all similar and we all eat grits. But actually, the South is many, many different places. The South of Florida is very different than Georgia. The South of Atlanta is very different than Deep Step. Charleston is not the same as New Orleans. And so depending on the sort of flavor you need is going to depend on the aspect of the South you want to single on.
Mm-hmm. Bone's condition of not being able to go through doorways mirrors his impasse with not completing his dissertation, not writing his book. Is the Lemangello syndrome really a metaphor?
Well, of course it is. Of course it is. And when I started writing it, I knew that not being able to go through a door was a metaphor. That particular piece of the story came from an interview I'd seen decades ago with the British comedian Terry Thomas. He had gap tooth and this big mustache that looked like he had an exploded toothbrush under his lower lip. And he was a Parkinson's sufferer. And he explained before going on a treatment that he was unable sometimes to get through doors. And that because he'd had vaudeville training, his technique to get through was he'd do a little shuffle off to Buffalo dance step and he could get through. And I was charmed with his resourcefulness, his lack of self-seriousness, and I thought about how terrible it would be for someone who wasn't like Terry Thomas, who wasn't gifted with laughing at himself, who was compelled sometimes in public to do a dance, to do something the rest of us do without even thinking. And so Dr. Lemangello, of course, tells Bone that to get through doors, all he has to do is a dance. And since he is a true Southerner, the only dance he can reliably do is a square dance.
Even though he lives in the New South.
Even though he lives in the New South. It's a new square dance.
The name, it's not identical to that delicious Italian liqueur. It's not limoncello. It's Lemangello, which is pronounced Lemangello. How did you arrive at that?
I don't know if I can say this, but I guess I will. My sister is a gerontologist, and at one time there was a very renowned gerontologist whose name was Lemangello, was the last name, spelled L-I-M-O-N-G-E-L-L-O, And however it's pronounced in Italian, it had been Americanized to Limoncello. And she just shared that name with me as a curiosity. And of course, it just goes into my data bank of little tidbits I may need one day. And so that's the character Limoncello is loosely based on Oliver Sacks, this sort of eccentric, charming neurologist who specializes in very peculiar ailments.
That's wonderful. Reading this book took me back to eighth grade when I loved to diagram sentences. A friend and I once tried to diagram the preamble to the Constitution.
Oh, my word.
It took us about 20 minutes. Anyway, Bone takes great comfort in diagramming sentences. It helps guide him. What was your editor's reaction to including sentence diagrams in your novel?
This is the only novel you'll read this year that has a sentence diagram in it. My agent and my editor both love the idea. And so I have a sort of faith that, and it's something I love to do when I write, I'll take almost any notion, if it's etymologies or sentence diagrams, and pursue them to the weirdest logical extreme. And I truly have a kind of faith that if you do that, you will uncover some unsuspected truth, however bizarre it is. And sure enough, in looking at sentence diagrams, I think, oddly, and again, I don't want to overstate it, do not conflate me with Bone, I think there is a kind of truth, there is a sort of revelation when you look at how sentences appear when they're diagrammed.
Well, this may be a good time to mention that you are also a cartoonist. Does being a writer inform your illustrations?
I think it might be the other way around. I was a cartoonist for years before I took up writing. Briefly, for many years, I had a syndicated comic strip called Sibling Revelry, which was not enough to get me shaved in the morning. What cartooning taught me was how to tell a story, how to tell it simply, and that there's a rising action and a falling action. Even in a three-panel cartoon, all these things are in place. The world I write about very much is a kind of cartoon world. If you looked carefully at Bone, you would realize he is delineated by a solid black line. The trees are simple green with brown trunks, and the sky is blue, sort of unquestioningly. The world I live in is very much a world of sort of silly putty characters who, fortunately for the most part, Bone doesn't quite fare so well, bounce when they fall instead of break.
Early in his encounter with Dr. Limoncello, Bone is given assignments. What is the prescription for Bone King for self-dislodgement?
Well, so what self-dislodgement is fundamentally, he fails to empathize with other people. And this is the problem with his wife. Ultimately, he just doesn't get it. He's not plugged into other people. And so really, it comes down to just trying to be a somewhat better person. Every day, he's got to express gratitude. He says, this is a great day, and he claps his hand. He has to do unasked for good deeds without refusing or seeking thanks. And he's got to pay unexpected compliments to strangers. And he does those things. And as he does them, I think he does begin to grow a little bit. As ridiculous as the treatment is, it is effective for him in what really matters.
Well, and it's so funny because all three of those things are so foreign to him.
Exactly.
And require such effort. What effect did complimenting have on Bone?
I think what it does, if you compliment a stranger, and I encourage you to try this. Years ago at a mall, my mother and I tried this game. And what we did was we walked through the mall. This is probably a terrible thing to do. And we took turns. And each person we met, we had to say one nice thing. However, we dredged it up. So my mother would compliment someone on his red hair. I would compliment someone on their smile. And we just took turns walking through stores, running into strangers, and deliberately complimenting them. It was a euphoric experience. The people were pleased and delighted. I felt embarrassed, but also pleased. And I think the effect on Bone King is very much the effect on me, and it would be the same effect on anybody. It does establish this connection with another person, even in the most arbitrary way. And it's one of the great gifts of the South is that Southerners will talk to other people. They will offer unsolicited compliments. And that's a thing, that's a good thing to do. I'll just tell you, everybody should do that at least once a day.
In the end, Bone realizes something important about love, which he cannot help himself from seeing in terms of punctuation marks. What does he finally understand?
This is a nice thing. I think the sentences are, there is a meaning to them. Love is not a period, it's a semicolon. And as a 10th grade English teacher, I will tell you a semicolon is not a full stop. It indicates that another full thought is on its way. There's a tendency among people, you know, you get married, you get in a relationship to think, okay, we're done. Now I finished that, I'll go about my other business. But there's a continuation there. And love is not a period. It's a movement forward. Otherwise, it is a full stop.
Man Martin, it really has been a joy to talk with you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
I wish you lots of luck with the Limoncello syndrome.
Thank you. It's been a delight.